from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum this morning, since July's terror attack in Nice, coastal towns across France have banned the full-body swimsuit known as the burkini. France already bans public use of the burqa, a veil that covers everything but the eyes, and we'll discuss the struggles of cultural assimilation, how Muslim women have adapted, and what the burqa symbolizes to Muslims and non-Muslims alike. Join us for Forum. It's right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. More than 20 coastal towns throughout France have banned the burkini, a full-bodied swimsuit which covers the body and head, and have done so in the face of tensions that go back to the ban of the burqa, a veil that covers everything on a woman but her eyes. The debate over such bans continues to rage throughout Europe and goes before France's highest administrative court today, following an appeal by a French NGO, the Human Rights League. And in this opening hour, the second hour of Forum, we want to take up the debate. Let me just add a few other things. The Guardian is actually reporting that burkini ban protesters are in front of the French embassy in London, staging what they are calling a beach party. That's probably going on right now. As we speak here in Corsica with a socialist mayor, there's a ban on the burkini. And in a German court ruling on earlier Monday this week, there was essentially agreement with an expulsion of an 18-year-old woman student for wearing a full-body veil, the niqab. So a lot of these are very much, these questions in addition to burkini are very much in the news. In fact, let me just, niqab, excuse me, let me just add niqab. Let me add one more thing here. The Citadel. The military college in South Carolina is actually considering a student request to wear a hijab, and that would be unprecedented. That is unprecedented to have any exception to the school's longstanding uniform requirement of 125 years. So we're going to try to take all of this in, but really talk about the burkini, which is getting a great deal of attention. And let me tell you who is joining us for the hour. We have Asma Uddin with us, and she's in Maryland. She's Director of Strategy for the Center for Islam and Religious Freedom. And welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Hala Arafta with us. And Hala Arafta is a retired program review analyst with the International Bureau of Broadcasting, former news editor with the Arabic branch of Voice of America, and she's in Fairfax, Virginia. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Will. Thank you.
Good morning to you. And Samina Usman is here with us in studio. She's a government relations coordinator with the Bay Area Office of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Samina Usman, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. Let me begin with you, and let me begin by asking a question which looms over this whole debate. Banning people from wearing what they want to wear, some would say Islamophobia.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's surprising because, you know, you would expect a Western country like France to embrace the concept of, you know, freedom of, you know, practicing one's faith. And it's unfortunate that you have these policies that go back to 2004 where one is not allowed to wear religious symbols in schools and then now even on the beach.
Well, you're here in the Bay Area. You're wearing a headpiece right now. But we should get probably the terminology of all of these.
Yeah, so this is what I'm wearing. It's a hijab, and it covers my hair.
And you want to wear it as an expression of your religious belief, your cultural ties, your traditions, et cetera, all of the above.
And that's the beauty of America's First Amendment rights, that we have the ability to practice our religion and that I'm able to wear what I choose to wear and also not choose to wear what I don't want to wear as well.
Well, in France, it's sort of the the state shielding from religion. In fact, you know, France has laws about wearing large Christian crosses, about skull caps, yarmulkes, and so forth. I mean, they want French to be French. So there's quite a contrast when you go across the Atlantic that you're talking about here, isn't there?
And who's to say that one can't be a Muslim or somebody who's Jewish or somebody who's a religious Catholic and not be French as well? I mean, there's, you know, you have 7% of the over 7% of the population of people in France who are Muslim or profess to be Muslim. Muslim, and you have a larger number of people who are Arab as well, who might choose to want to wear their cultural clothing, but it doesn't make them any less French.
Let's talk about the difference in religious clothing. Hijab, niqab, burqa. I mean, can you break it down for us, please?
So the hijab is what's generally known as for somebody who covers their hair and they cover their arms up to their hands and, you know, down to their feet. And so that's what's most commonly worn amongst Muslims. And, of course, there's a large number of Muslim women who choose not to wear the hijab, obviously. The niqab would be somebody who chooses to cover their face. And the burqa would be more referred to somebody who is wearing, it's more cultural clothing, something that's longer, something that's more flowy, more associated with, I'm assuming, people in Afghanistan.
Is there tension between women who choose to wear these and perhaps even maybe looking down on women or young girls who don't?
Well, I mean, I think that, again, I think in Islam, you have the freedom to practice your religion. There's no compulsion in religion. And so, you know, I have friends who choose to wear the hijab, who choose to not wear the hijab, and people who even wear the niqab as well. And we all, you know, work together. I would not be able to say that there aren't any tensions where people might say, oh, you know, maybe you should wear the hijab, or, you know what, maybe we're living in America, maybe you should take it off. Of course, these conversations are happening in one's homes and schools. But again, it all comes down to one's choice of how to practice one's faith.
This becomes, in many ways, whether we like it or not, politicized. I mean, in France, for example, because of the terrorism that occurred in France. And looking at some pictures, in fact, courtesy of Hala Rafa, who we'll talk to, of pictures taken in Egypt in the 50s and 60s. Now, there may have been some of them Coptic Christians, but the fact is nobody was wearing these things in the 50s and 60s, none of the women in these pictures. And then you move forward in the 70s and there's some wearing. As in the present period, almost all the women are wearing them in Egypt. I mean, so things kind of morph and change and mutate, I suppose you could say.
Well, the last time I went to Egypt, I mean, I saw a mix of people of people who wear the scarf and people who don't wear
now
the
scarf.
Now
you do, yeah.
So, you know, you do see that. And you see, like, when I went to Egypt, I mean, I went to Sharm el-Sheikh and I saw people who were wearing burkinis and people who were wearing Speedos. So you had a mix of people there. And you know, people should have the right to wear what they want to on the beach in Egypt. And as well as in France.
Again, Samina Usman is Government Relations Coordinator for the Bay Area Office of the Consul on American Islamic Relations. And Asma Uddin is Director of Strategy for the Center for Islam and Religious Freedom. You did a piece in the New York Times. Asma, let's talk about that first. What did you want to put forward there?
Sure. Well, I mean, my piece in the New York Times was connecting the rationale, the public order and security rationale offered in support of the burkini ban to similar rationales that were heard by, you know, various courts all the way up to the highest court of human rights in Europe, the European Court of Human Rights, and the ways in which rationales that might seem kind of strange and unsupported to the average American were actually upheld by the court. But I wanted to back up a little because I earlier in this conversation, both you and Samina were connecting the burkini ban to similar other bans in France. And you had mentioned, you had started us off by talking about the burqa ban and the full face covering. And, you know, I just wanted to point out that in you know, it was a clever marketing strategy for the creator of the burkini to call it a burkini. But unfortunately, that naming has raised issues that might be unnecessary in the sense that a lot of the concerns and I would say even fears that are associated with a face covering don't. You know, in other words, a burqa they're not relevant here because the burkini actually doesn't cover the face. And so there's a lot of conflation happening here between the burqa and burkini when, in fact, they're fundamentally different.
No, I thank you for that important distinction. We don't want to conflate these things. But you yourself have talked about concerns you have about the ban, the feeling it doesn't work and feeling that maybe it raises serious questions about human rights. But also you did express, as I recall, in the New York Times piece, you did some hygiene concerns which have been brought to the fore here, too, with the burkini specifically.
Right. Well, in the piece, I didn't get into hygiene issues, but that is another argument that's being put forward as a concern, which, you know, I'm not really sure what the evidence for that is. Again, there are a number of allegations and statements being made here, but I think few of them are actually supported by real evidence. And I think on the hygiene question, you know, the question that arises for me is how is it fundamentally different from a wetsuit?
It seemed like the big question you were raising was consistency and enforcement. I mean, approaching it from a legal point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a number of issues. I mean, so, you know, going back to the school ban that we were talking about earlier, which, you know, covers conspicuous religious symbols of all types, interestingly, that both the school law and the Cannes bikini ban law, if you look at it, uses pretty much the same language, and they both kind of focus on this idea of conspicuous symbols of, you know, or ostentatious religious appearance. It's pretty much exactly the same language, which raises the question as to what extent, you know, the broadness and scope of the school ban is going to be translated into this beachwear ban. Although, you know, latest news reports show that, you know, I'm sure you heard of the public enforced disrobing of a woman both in Cannes and another one in Nice. And there was a context there where someone said, well, what about, you know, crosses? Why are you going to enforce this ban against, you know, ostentatious religious appearance against those wearing crosses? And the policeman said, no, this is not the issue here. We're not dealing with crosses. And so in contrast to what might have seen a slightly more neutral application in the school ban context, what we're seeing here is something very squarely focused on Muslim religious clothing. And I think now a lot of officials, I mean, I saw a report today saying that they're really concerned about the enforceability of the measure because there are other women who are not Muslim who are wearing modest wear or women wearing, you know, similar types of clothing for other purposes, such as wanting to prevent a sunburn. And they're really having a difficult time trying to, you know, to draw those lines, which in turn also emphasizes the discriminatory aspect of this law and the fact that of all these different, reasons why people might be wearing something more modest than a typical swimsuit, the ones that are being zeroed in on and the only one that's being penalized is the Muslim religious motivation.
What about the I was just going to follow that up with a question about the bigger argument that you're hearing out of France, that this is a threat to public order, particularly in light of terrorist attacks that occurred. And, when you're in France, you should be doing what the French are doing and essentially modify your dress to be like the French. When in Rome, do like the Romans and so forth.
Yeah, well, to that, I mean, the broader point there is what Samina said about, well, you know, who's to say this isn't being French, right? And who gets to define that? Is this something the government totally gets to define, or is it something that the individuals have a say in as well? There was something else I was going to say about that.
Well, let me actually hear from Hala Arafa, who's also with us, who takes a very different point of view. She's a retired program review analyst with the International Bureau of Broadcasting, a former news editor at the Arabic branch of Voice of America. And Hala Arafa, you've taken a pretty strong stance against the ban, in favor of the ban because—
For the ban, yes.
For the ban, yeah. You say it's toxic ideology.
It is.
And let's—
It is not just a dress or a cover. It entails an ideology that in modern day life we have discarded completely because it makes the woman's body something shameful that needs to be covered. It puts the onus on her to prevent any kind of rape or sexual attack, and the man is not responsible. It's her dress, which, again, is another idea that we fought terribly in order to abolish from our thinking today.
And what about the idea that this is a question maybe of modesty and piety, that those need to be seen?
Yes, exactly. That's another thing also, is that if it is a modesty thing, why are you in public? I mean, Orthodox Jewish women are pious and they cover, but the concept of covering means that they do not share the public space.
I think the most disturbing point that you raise, I mean, for many, would be that this essentially in some ways not only contributes to, I'll use this language advisedly, rape culture, but
it does.
But it also, from your perspective, puts women in a role of servitude. Now, explain those to me, if you could.
When you put the onus on the woman to cover up so she will not be attacked, when she's ashamed of her sexuality and of her body, and she has to be wrapped up because the man cannot control his urges, and if she's not covered up, he's going to attack her. That encourages the rape mentality and the rape culture. This started in the early 1980s in Egypt and ended up with the newer generation believing that they have the right to attack any woman who's not covered. Example of that is the gang sexual assault in Germany last Christmas. The similar thing happened in Sweden and other European countries. The kids grew up with the idea that they are entitled to this. And it's the woman's, the victim's, responsibility to cover herself up. I'm not a criminal if I do that. I'm justified in doing that. While it's not a written rule, it's a tacit approval of that kind of behavior.
Let me go back to Asma Uddin and get her response to what you just said. And we ought to, quote Hala Rafa here, who says that the burqa ban is an act of socially conscious, morally courageous, and responsible act. Actually, it enhances prudence and benefits and has a great deal of foresight behind it. I mean, that's essentially your argument. But particularly the way she's framed it here, Asma Uddin, is it's ideological and it perpetuates a rape culture.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, Hala started off by saying that we've just disregarded this sort of clothing and the ideology that she says attaches to it. And my question really is, who is we? And, you know, again, going back to the idea that the French government, is it some sort of notion of a uniform, monolithic global culture that has come to a unanimous consensus on this issue? And I would say, obviously, no. And I think that, you know, that type of position where it attaches these types of fears and your own personal assumptions and stereotypes to what this clothing represents essentially robs these women of agency, women who wear it for both secular and religious reasons, and who do it as a way of, for a variety of reasons, again, for it could be for their own sense of modesty and their valuing of modesty, very separate from questions about the male gaze, to simply questions of comfort or medical reasons or wanting to prevent a sunburn. And once again, a law that sort of attaches this sort of assumed, you know, universal consensus that we have moved past, you know, this understanding of modesty as a positive, or that this is something that's archaic, you know, it's just overbroad, and it just encompasses so many different, you know, women who are doing it for different reasons.
Yeah, let me go back to Hala Rafa on this. I mean, shouldn't clothing be a choice, whether it's religious or culture? You want to identify perhaps with choice over your adopted country?
It should be a choice, but only a choice when there is no religious dogma harmful that has religious dogma that has proven harmful to the society. And when I say we, just to explain myself, people who are living and wearing 21st century clothes, who are not living with ideas of the 7th century and the clothes of the 7th century. Every century, every time in human history, the clothes represented ideas of that time.
Let me go back to Samina Usman, who's here with us in studio from the Bay Area Office of the Consul on American Islamic Relations, and she's Government Relations Coordinator. You've got a daughter who's, what, 7?
Yes, I have a 7-year-old daughter.
Mm-hmm. What do you tell her about this?
Well, I mean, for now, she's 7 years old, so we don't discuss this. But, I mean, when it comes time for her to choose whether or not to wear the scarf, that will be, again, her choice. I mean, I chose to...
You're not trying to pressure her?
Of course not. No, I chose to wear the scarf when I was in college. My mom chose to wear it in her mid-30s. You know, it's just whenever one decides to do so. And if she decides not to wear it, I will also respect her right to do that.
And what you just heard about this being linked to ideology in the 7th century?
I mean, hijab has never prevented me from carrying out anything that I've wanted to do. I mean, I go swimming in the beach. I lay in the beach. I am going to be going for a mud run to help, you know, for the National MS Society. I'm not going to let that prevent me, and nor did Ibtihaj Muhammad when she won her bronze medal. So, I mean, you have this idea that hijab is going to prevent me from taking part in the world is completely preposterous, because it does not stop me from carrying out all the things that I've wanted to carry out.
We should mention she was, of course, one of the Olympic competitors who won a medal. And I wonder if I could get you to talk about this in a broader context again. I don't want to conflate, but there's a lot of fear of moving toward Sharia or moving toward the insistence of Sharia, not only in Europe, but here in the United States. I'm sure you've heard this expressed, not only by perhaps Americans and Frenchmen, but even by people of Islamic faith, that there would be, if you allow or permit the vestiges of clothing and so forth, you're going to maybe move it in that direction.
Well, there has been a move to prevent Sharia law from making its way into the U.S. You have 10 states that have passed some form of anti-Sharia or anti-Muslim laws. And what Sharia, in fact, is, it's just a code of conduct. It's a way of following one's religion in terms of It dictates my inheritance laws. It dictates my marriage contract. It dictates those things. And again, you know, one would choose to follow that or not. And the thing is that it would not supersede American law, but the fact that these states are going to prevent me from writing a contract for my marriage is ridiculous. That that the government is trying to get into my daily life and is infringing on my religious liberty.
We should mention here that there are, since we're talking about the United States, there are Somali basketball players, young Somali women who are trying to get into this balance. They have a new kind of uniform, a sports uniform. It's a hijab, and it actually connects by Velcro in the back of the neck. It's not a pullover, but it's fastened with Velcro in the back. So bikini, all of these kinds of things are sort of evolving in different ways. And I'm interested in finding out what listeners think about this and what your thoughts are, not only, but what your questions are. We're talking about all these images that have come across to us of French police actually fining beachgoer for hassling them, I suppose you could say, but also telling them they're making a public display that can create disorder. The debate is going on. The debate is going to be decided sometime today. And it's fueled the whole debate over feminism, Islamophobia, religious freedom. And we're discussing this controversy, which is going on and which you can weigh in on here. Let me, in fact, invite you to do that. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. We'd like to hear what your thoughts are and any questions or comments you might have. And again, you can join us now toll-free at 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org. And if you're a Muslim woman, we'd especially like to hear your thoughts on veil and dress restrictions. Please feel free to join the program. You can also go to our website and post any questions or comments you might have there, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Talking with Samina Usman, who's here with us in studio, Government Relations Coordinator for the Bay Area Office of the Consul on American Islamic Relations. With us by phone from Fairfax, Virginia, Hala Arafa, who is retired program review analyst with the International Bureau of Broadcasting and former news editor of the Arabic branch of Voice of America. And also with us by phone from Maryland is Azmaudin, who is Director of Strategy with the Center for Islam and Religious Freedom. When we return, we'll hear from you, our listeners. Stay tuned. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're focusing this hour on recent controversy around French coastal towns banning a full-bodied swimsuit called a burkini. Are you a Muslim woman? Well, we'd like to hear your thoughts on veil and dress restrictions, which is the broader context for this discussion. And as I said, things are certainly happening throughout Europe as we speak. There's a decision being made about the ban, and also protests going on in front of the French embassy in London, a burkini beach in. We're already getting, as I would have anticipated, some responses. Here's Sean, who writes, the burqa was banned because it hides a woman's face in public, and that is an extreme abnegation of personhood as well as a security threat. The burkini does not pose such problems. We cannot imagine France's prime minister refusing to receive a male member of the Saudi royal family covered in his traditional robes and headdress, so why should a similarly covered Muslim woman be treated any differently? And another listener writes, no one should be policing women's bodies. This is essentially forcing women to wear less. What is this, a sorority? No, thank you. Well, You may want to weigh in, and indeed you can do so by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and clicking on this segment. Or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And let me go to your calls. Let's go first to Olivia. Olivia, you're on. Morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I studied in Egypt at the University of Cairo, and while I was there, a lot of my fellow students who were women were taking the hijab and wearing the scarf more and more. And when I would ask them why, they would say, well, this is our response to the pressure from the West. We don't believe that we're going to find our answers there. You know, we're going to find our answers in the Quran. So I just don't think that we can win them over ideologically by force. It has to be a matter of, you know, encouraging those ideals out of people, not forcing them to dress how we want. It's just going to push them more and more into a corner and a reaction.
Yeah, I wonder, Hala or Rafa, what you say to that, please?
I do not advocate anybody forcing anybody to do anything. And if they want to wear it, they're more than welcome to wear it, but not in the shared public space. Their freedom of religion should not, it stops when it interferes with the society's freedom of being a secular society. They can do whatever they, practicing their religion, by the way, means that they worship without fear, without intimidation, but it does not mean, practice does not mean that they impose their ideas on me and on the public space. And when I say me, let me clarify that. Somebody who believes in the 21st century's ideas regarding the female sexuality, the freedom, the individuality, and all of that.
Well, let's hear from Asma Uddin. Asma Uddin.
I think it's not fair to the seculars to have their space invaded by ideas that are rejected by modern-day standards and modern-day thinking.
Again, this has been your expressed view throughout. Let me go to Asma Uddin, though, who's director of strategy with the Center for Islam and Religious Freedom. Asma Uddin?
Yeah, I mean, just to respond to some of Hala's points, I mean, she says she doesn't believe in force, but she does support the burkini ban, which in essence is government coercion. And so if you don't support force, then you can't legitimately support a government ban. You know, then she kind of says this is about, well, you can do it in private, but you can't come into shared public space. But as it turns out, notions of modesty primarily play out in public spaces. You know, in private spaces, you're less inclined to want to, you know, express modesty, at least in physical dress terms. So essentially, the public space is the relevant space that we're talking about when it comes to dress and modesty. This idea of that you can't invade a secular space and that other seculars can't have their space invaded, I mean, yeah, this is the type of rationale that came up in the burqa ban case that was heard by the European Court of Human Rights, and they ultimately ended up supporting the ban on the basis of, you know, preserving the conditions of quote-unquote living together. And this idea that somehow that others are offended by what you're wearing, that you have no right to wear it. And so, you know, on the one hand, it should strike us as all a little bit strange that one set of people, somehow their rights are privileging over, you know, over others. You know, the ones who are offended by the burqa are ultimately privileged by the ones who want to wear a certain type of clothing. And it also just creates this right not to be offended, which if you really think about it in terms of its logical implications and ramifications, that just extends quite broad. I mean, I've seen some people kind of draw parallels between, well, isn't this the same country that said, you know, just we, Charlie, you know, like we, you know, in this adamant support of free expression, and yet when the free expression moves beyond a newspaper or a cartoon to the expression in, you know, as reflected in your clothing, which is a paradigmatic, you know, type of expression, at least in the American context, right? We wear what we wear because we want to express ourselves. There's this obvious, stark, you know, dishonesty there.
Well, it's also, it goes back to the attempt to create a multicultural society as opposed to assimilation interests or desire to have assimilation or to protect one's own identity. I'm reading a comment here in favor of the ban by a listener named Ben who says, I'm French, and this situation is a result of a handful of provocateurs who want to impose their way of life to the French society. We have a saying which is, in Rome, do as the Romans. Also, Can anyone confirm that beach activities were mentioned in the Quran? Now, actually, several listeners are asking what the Quran says about beachwear. Asma, can I go to you on that? I mean, I didn't mean to make this into a joke, but actually we're getting those kind of questions.
There was no beach at the time, I don't think.
Well, the Quran doesn't specifically address beachwear. It just addresses broad notions of modesty. I mean, there's, you know, a theological debate in itself because the headscarf, you know, explicitly is not mentioned in the Quran, but there are interpretations and historical contextual analysis that say that was intended by some of the verses.
But isn't a lot of this is cultural, the idea? I mean, for example, Islam has been linked to female circumcision, and yet there's nothing in Islam or in the Quran about female circumcision. It just evolved for cultural reasons. How much of this, in other words, evolved for cultural reasons?
I take full responsibility for that. For the circumcision, as an Egyptian old pharaonic practice, it has nothing to do with Islam. And it spread from Egypt. And as a matter of fact, in Saudi Arabia, they don't do it at all. They don't know it. And in Asia. And if they started doing it, I, as an Egyptian, apologize to everybody. It's a cultural tradition that was carried on.
You don't have to take on all that guilt personally.
It was a cultural tradition that was carried on after Christianity and Islam. I mean, in Egypt, Christians do it as well. So it really has no religious connotations whatsoever.
Well, how much of that is true, though, for a lot of the covering of the body and the desire to keep the flesh concealed?
This is the new ideas that came with the fundamentalists at the beginning of 1980s. And
this is Salafism, as opposed to Islam or a branch of Islam?
Well, if you look at Iran, they're not Salafis. It's a very orthodox or fundamentalist idea that Sunnis and the Shia also do it.
All right, I've got a lot of callers, and I want to get to as many as I can. But let me go to Samina Usman for a moment, though, here with a question from Casey. Do your guests believe, and I'll just ask you this, Samina, that the West's negative reaction to hijabs, burqas, and burkinis is because of their erroneous equating of all Muslims to jihadist extremists, or is it because they view it as retrogressive to women's rights and equality?
Mm-hmm. And again, the idea that wearing the hijab, burqa, niqab, whatever, would be kind of a symbol of supporting terror or supporting these horrible beliefs is basically placing collective blame on the entire 1.6 billion Muslims around the world for the actions of a few, just because they might have this, I wouldn't even say extremist, it's twisted ideology that they claim to be Islam, when in fact it would not be at all. And Muslim women who choose to wear hijab, they choose to because they believe that it is part of their religion and part of their faith. It doesn't make them any more Muslim. It doesn't make them any less Muslim. And I think the whole debate goes down to a woman's right to choose. And I think a woman should have the right to choose what they do with their body. And that would be
you include abortion in
whether or not that's their right, you know, within the law.
I have to ask because of the language is often used about abortion
rights.
Exactly.
So, I mean, this is their right to choose if to wear a burqa or wear a hijab or wear a niqab or wear a burkini or wear a bathing suit.
Or get married or stay single or on and on we can go.
Exactly. That's their right to choose, and that should not be robbed of them.
Let me bring another caller on here, and this is Neelesh. I think I may have lost her. Let me go to Neil then. Neil, you're on.
Exactly how voluntary is the worship? Is the wearing of the veils and the other clothing? Does anybody really think that women actually choose, in most cases anyway, to wear this stuff? What people are really afraid of are the importing of things like honor killing, or the women who have been blinded, as in England, if they refuse to wear certain kinds of clothing.
Honor killing is done by thugs and murderers. It's not a religious practice.
The choice issue, it is not a choice if you tell the woman that it is mandated by God. If you tell the woman you can choose to listen to God's orders or not, or be a sinner, that is not a choice.
All right, I want to bring more callers on here, and let me go next to Joe. Joe, you're on. Morning.
First off, I want to admit something just to kind of put the comments in context. I'm a white man. I'm middle-aged. I live in Oakland. I see a lot of women in burqas nowadays around. And frankly, I feel a little uncomfortable about it. But here's the thing. I realize it's none of my damn business. Them wearing burqas doesn't make me convert to Islam or point it towards Mecca. You know, I hardly go to church as it is. So when I, like, first off, it's not our business. So why are the French telling women not to wear burqas? And frankly, when I heard the lady panelist saying that the burqa is part of some kind of rape culture, it makes me wonder what she's talking about when a minute ago we were saying that if a woman wore a slinky red dress, that's somehow an invitation to rape.
But we've gotten over that. The law has gotten over that. If somebody said she was wearing a miniskirt so I couldn't help myself and I raped her, the courts are not going to accept that.
All right. Let me bring another comment in here from a listener named Tricia who wants to understand the reasoning here. She says, I'm not in favor of banning clothing unless there are legitimate national security concerns. However, I am interested in whether these coverings are style choices or religious choices. If so, what is the religious reason? Why only do women get covered and why not men? Regardless of the reasoning, I still believe in protecting the religious practices, but I'd like to understand the reasoning. Can you help us with the religious practices, Asma Uddin?
Well, I mean, I think that it's person to person and community to community. I mean, one of the responses that has come out in response to the burkini ban is the presence of, for instance, nuns in full habit on beaches or other women who are wearing modest wear for secular reasons. And so I think that, you know, trying to pinpoint why people wear modest clothes and specifically why it's more women who wear modest clothes, I think it's not something that necessarily has to be traced back to Islam or even, for that matter, to religious reasoning. I think that... Go ahead.
There's also been this question that's come up repeatedly about the threat to public order. And Halal Rafah, I mean, you see that as a real piece of this, don't you?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. And another thing also, that this question of the caller is very important. It is not the piece of clothing. It is not the cloth. It is the ideology behind it that a woman's body is shameful and needs to be covered, that her honor is connected to her dress. It is not the burkini in itself, and it's not the piece of cloth on the head in itself, but what it represents.
There's a weird paradox here, though. You're talking about rules about women and what they can wear on the grounds that it's wrong to have to obey rules about what women should wear or shouldn't wear. I'm also struck by the fact, and I wanted to mention this, that in Morocco now, burkinis are banned. I mentioned this before for hygienic reasons, and that does play into this whole controversy. But we'll bring on more of your calls. We want to go to Shireen next. Shireen, thank you for waiting. Join us.
Hi. I grew up in Egypt, and I do think that women should be able to choose what they want to wear. But growing up in a city like that, where it's really hot most of the time, I always thought that the headscarf, and in particular the burqa or the niqab, seemed like it's pretty oppressive. It looks like it's not comfortable. So I'm really curious to know what your guests think about that.
Samin, you wanted to respond?
Okay, I mean, a lot of people actually choose to wear more clothing in the sun, especially now. You see a lot of the swimsuits for kids. That's what I have for both my son and also my daughter, would be more covering in order to prevent from UV rays. So in it helps to prevent from sunburn. So in reality, it actually helps to prevent you from UV exposure. So I actually think it's much better than not.
We go to another caller. Ali, welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you, sir. I want to say I was born in a Muslim country. I have traveled to over 120 countries. I am well familiar with this. I believe these people that allege that they want to dress according to their religion are the mother of all hypocrites. They want to come and enjoy the freedoms of Western countries, yet they claim they want to be Muslim, and they want to wear varied stages of hijab. Some of them just their eyes showing, some of them half of their hair showing, whatnot. I want to ask you, does Saudi Arabia allow Westerners to go there and dress as they like? If they really want to be Muslims, if they really are truly believing in their religion, which I don't believe these rules come from God, but they come from some Arab man who was born 1,400 years ago, then they can go live in a Muslim country where those laws are welcomed and encouraged. Why do they want to come to a place like Paris where women wear cross-level miniskirts and wear burkina and say, I'm a Muslim, as though it's a kind of an accomplishment to be a Muslim?
All right. Let me thank you, Ellie, for the call. We'll just let that stand as an editorial call. And reading some more comments here. Marie says, France has accepted them as French. They should respect French laws, period. Gina tweets, what about Christian monks and nuns or Buddhists? Does the ban apply to them too? And the answer, I believe, is no. But let me go to more of your calls. In the meantime, we bring on Nilesh. Nilesh, welcome.
Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Thank you so much for having me. I just wanted to say, well, to that nun point, you know, nuns do walk around in habits in France, and how is that so different from the headscarf? My second point is I'm an American of Indian descent, and women in Hindu culture wear, you know, six-yard wraparounds called a sari. And I think they would balk at the concept that, you know, a dress, which is fairly cumbersome, is somehow oppressive to them, and they would feel affronted if you told them, oh, you can't wear the sari, you know, being a law-abiding citizen. So that's just, you know, from another religious perspective.
Okay, and I thank you for that other religious perspective. Yes. And we've been talking about gender a bit. Let me get Margot on here because she is a little... but Samina, you wanted to say something here before we go to Margot.
Yeah, and it also brings the question, what about people who are Sikh and who want to wear their turban? Or what about people who are cancer patients and want to cover their hair because they're going through chemo? I mean, what about people who are genuinely concerned, again, to the UV rays exposure and you know, getting skin cancer? So, you know, again, I think that it brings all these questions into concern. I mean, the woman who had her her shirt, she was asked to take her shirt off while she was on the beach in Cannes. She was not wearing a burkini. She was just wearing a long sleeve shirt, and she had a head wrap. But she was just laying in the sun, and she was told to take that off, and you know, had a fine because of that. Again, you know, people wear more clothing for different reasons, and so imposing this type of a ban on the beaches of France is counterproductive, and it's imposing the idea that you can't be French unless you wear a bathing suit. And I think that's ridiculous.
And I did say we get Margot on next. Margot, go ahead, please.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for taking my call. Sure. I must say, I live in San Francisco, and we have a lot of different cultural people here. And I fundamentally believe that all of them should be able to express what they want to express by their clothing. But I also will say it angers me, actually, when I go places and I see Muslim families, and the small children, the girls, are wearing a hijab, or, and they have to, and the boys are not. Why are the boys not modest? You know, if it is a question of modesty, I don't know why the boys have complete freedom. I was just at a water park in Denver. It was 100 degrees, and there were four teenage girls, and they all had full dress, and the boys were in shorts and T-shirts and looked quite comfortable. And I just feel like it's a double standard in that way. If it's not a way to submit to the ideology of long ago thinking that it's a problem for a woman's body to be shown, I feel like the boys should be doing something too. It's obviously a male-dominated tradition, in my view.
And Asma Hayuddin?
Yeah, I mean, I can agree that contrast, especially in something like a water park, can be a little bit unsettling. But ultimately, I mean, that goes back to questions of, you know, just women and women's bodies, and then and the way that socially, you know, modesty is defined differently for men and women. You know, whether it be why are men, you know, non-Muslim men on beaches wearing shorts from, you know, their waist to their knee, whereas women are wearing bikinis. I mean, that also just goes to just different conceptions of how we view, you know, modesty and appearance and what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. And within the Muslim context, yes, there is this idea that a woman's body has to be covered to a greater extent than a man's body. Whether or not that is necessarily, by definition, an oppressive belief is something that's up for debate.
And again, Asma Hayuddin is Director of Strategy with the Center for Islam and Religious Freedom. Perhaps most difficult thing perhaps to sort out here, at least from my perspective, is the religious from the cultural, and sometimes or the political, for that matter. And they're often bound together. I just wanted to bring in, for listeners' interest, some of you may have followed this story I did out of Switzerland, where a couple of young Muslim boys refused to shake hands with their teacher because of not wanting that tactile content or contact, felt it was cultural, religious, for whatever the reason. But it had been a custom in Switzerland. And at first they were said, the Swiss said, okay, they don't have to. And then the Swiss said, yes, they have to because this is our tradition and we want you to pretty much go along with our tradition culturally. These questions become, you know, very multidimensional and difficult. I'm going to go to another caller here, but let me read a comment from Eric who says, I'm much more concerned about freedom from religion than about freedom of religion. The burqa is a symbol of religious intolerance and otherness. France is a secular country and fought for years to get out from under religiously intolerant structures. They have a right to fight for their secular and modern way of life. Maureen writes, can any of the guests speak about secularity in France and previous issues they've successfully faced prior to Muslim clothing controversies? Anybody want to jump in here?
This is the point that I'm trying to make.
And this is, again, Arafa. Yeah.
Yes. This is the point I really vehemently was trying to pass through. It is not a piece of clothing. It is a mentality and an ideology behind the piece of clothing that we in the modern society have experienced under the domination of the religion, be it a church or whatever, and we've gotten over that hump, and we said we don't want the religion to dictate on us what we do. Now, you are free to practice your own religion as much as you want, but your freedom stops where mine begins. So I believe that a woman's body should be respected. She should be able to do and wear whatever she likes, but the dress that contradicts what we believe of a woman's sexuality today should not be in the public space. Now, we've gone through that horrible domination of religion on us. And what I want to say is that when they wear that and force me to accommodate their religious beliefs, they are imposing on my secular beliefs.
So no turbans for Sikhs and no yarmulkes for Jews?
The turban for a Sikh, don't focus on the item of clothing. Focus on what it represents. If you take the fashion part out of it and you focus on what it represents, then we have a discussion.
All right, I want to go to another caller, but first, Asma, to you, please respond.
Yeah, I mean, I think this question of what something represents is really, it's murky in itself, and I think that's exactly what's raising the enforcement issues. So separate, even if you completely take out the question of whether or not every single person who wears this is somehow wearing it as a reflection of oppression, which I obviously contest, there's also just this question of lots of different people wear similar types of modest swimwear for different reasons. And my question is purely from the enforcement angle, how the French government is going to parse through the various quote-unquote mentalities or motivations. And the fact that there's a law in existence that specifically targets a particular motivation to the exclusion of all other motivations underscores just how discriminatory this is.
All right. And here is Shabana, who has been waiting patiently. Shabana, you're on.
Hi. I just wanted to address to the speaker who said that the Muslim women are the Islamic religion, say that the body is for shame and that's why we're covering. No. You ask any Muslim woman, and you see her walking on the streets of San Francisco or any Bay Area street, ask her, are you doing it because you're ashamed? No. We as Muslim women treat our bodies of a place of honor, and anything that's precious, we try to cover. I think you don't take your $5 million diamond and you wear it around on the street. Yeah, you cover it. So that's one thing. Second, men are supposed to be dressing modestly just as the women. They have a different standard, and women have a different standard. And I just wanted to address that and clear it for everybody who wants to learn and not just, attack Islam. I would appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. I thank you for that comment from you, Samina.
So my apologies to Hala, but I feel like she's contradicting herself. She's saying that we have the right to do what we want, but at the same time, no, we're not allowed to go and wear what we want to out in the streets. My wearing the scarf is not doing anything to you. It's not. I'm not forcing you to wear the scarf. I'm not forcing you to wear the bikini. If you want to wear a bikini, you're more than welcome to do that. But the very fact that you are trying to infringe your beliefs, or the France is trying to infringe their, you know, beliefs as to what I should be wearing and not wearing, it's basically contradictory in itself, because forcing, you know, women to cover or uncover is contradictory to civil and human rights.
Let me ask Kala Ruffa to address that contradiction.
That.
Yeah.
It's when you wear this, you are... your ideas of what modesty is invading the ideas of what modesty is in secular terms. I am very modest. I wore suits to work, and my hair is not covered. My arms could not be covered at a certain time, but it is modest in my opinion, and in any workplace. There is a code for what the woman should wear and what the men should wear. They should be dressed in suits. We should be dressed in a certain way. We're not going to run around naked. Every society has its norms, and the burkini or the hijab is outside the norm because it connects the woman's honor to her dress.
On that note of modesty and honor, we will have to conclude this discussion, which was certainly a rich discussion. I want to thank all of the participants. You last heard from Hala Arafa from the Arabic branch of Voice of America. We also had Asma Uddin with us, Director of Strategy with the Center for Islam and Religious Freedom, and Samina Usman from the Bay Area Office of the Council on American Islamic Relations. Thank you for listening. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And you can continue this discussion online by going to kqed.org/forum. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. And our executive producer is Joanne Wallace. Thank you for listening. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation.